Welcome to Media Law and Ethics, a podcast series from Radford University. I'm Professor Bill Kovarik, and I'll be your guide through this complex but increasingly important area of concern for the emerging global culture. I've been a print journalist since the 1970s, and I've also studied media law at the University of Maryland and as a postdoc at Oxford University. This podcast is designed primarily for communication and computer science students in the United States who are required to know something about law and ethics of communication. However, I hope the podcast will also be available to anyone interested anywhere in this rapidly shrinking world. Those of you taking this course should know that it's offered through Radford University and accredited through the Southern Association of Colleges, and that it may be taken for college credit at many other universities on a distance education basis. There's more information about this course on my webpage, which is www.billkovarik.com. That's B-I-L-L-K-O-V-A-R-I-K. You'll see a link on the left side of my page to this class where you can find the syllabus, study notes, and a schedule for the class. There are also some notes on various subjects that are tied to these lectures. And so with some of the preliminaries out of the way, I think it's safe to go ahead and launch into the overview of our subject, media law and ethics. To begin with, it's no exaggeration to say that this is one of the most important concerns in the world today. The mass communications media touches everyone on the globe, and the independence of the media has long been recognized as the cornerstone of all human rights. In my view, we have arrived at a critical crossroads for free speech and human rights worldwide. Media law in one country can hardly be considered in a vacuum, since what every country does can now affect every other country. We are too small a planet, and we have too much at stake in terms of common destiny to continue ignoring each other. As a result, we see an increasing emphasis on what is called harmonization of international law and of media law. So to the extent possible, I'm going to try to add notes about media law in many nations, not only in the United States. Our first point of departure will be an overview of media law and the structures and institutions of the law, which in many cases are mirrored throughout the world. In our second podcast, we'll consider the history of free speech and freedom of press with the idea that every person on earth desires and deserves freedom. In the third podcast, we'll be looking at the ethical issues that should inform people who use the media. We'll be thinking about how and why freedom can be balanced with responsibility, and how professionals and the courts try to strike that balance. In subsequent podcasts, we'll be looking in detail at some of the questions about media law and ethics, questions like defamation or libel, questions about the protection of privacy, questions about copyright, the regulation of broadcasting and advertising, and questions about obscenity and indecency. So, let's get started. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and freedom of the press are principles that are held worldwide today and have long been valued in history. As Miraj al-Sudan said in 17th century Mali, the fundamental and original nature of humanity is that individuals are free. In the United States of America, the First Amendment to the Constitution is the cornerstone of media law. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Although the First Amendment is subject to interpretation, the general principles of U.S. media law are quite clear. As William Brennan said in New York Times versus Sullivan in 1964, we have a profound national commitment to the principle that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and that it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials. Now, commitment to freedom of speech and press is also explicit in many other countries, and probably the most significant international document is the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, which says, everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of frontiers. Of course, in Europe, there is the Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms, Article 10, which says everyone has the right to freedom of expression. This right shall include the freedom to hold opinions and to receive and impart information and ideas without interference by public authority and regardless of frontiers. That's very similar to the UN Declaration of Human Rights. In China, the basic idea of freedom of speech is honored in regulations on the administration of publishing, Article 5, which says all levels of the people's government shall ensure that citizens are able to legally exercise their right to freedom of publication. But here's the sticking point. It says, when citizens exercise their right to freedom of publication, they shall abide by the Constitution and laws, shall not oppose the basic principles confirmed in the Constitution, and shall not harm the interests of the country, the society, or the collective, or the legal freedoms and rights of other citizens. So that second clause is the sticking point. And the truth is that even minor challenges to political authority in China can be met with harsh jail terms or execution. According to Reporters Without Borders, press freedom is shrinking worldwide, not growing. In an era of rapidly increasing global communications technologies, this problem is a universal concern. So next, let's consider why we study media law. It seems to me that because the new media technologies give everyone the power of publishing, in fact, that we're all publishers now, some understanding of the subject is vital for nearly everyone who's engaged in media. It also seems that a balance between freedom and responsibility can be achieved, is being achieved in many democratic countries, even when freedom is in the preferred position. This is a concept that's at the foundation of a democratic society, but it's not always accepted, even sometimes in provincial areas of democratic nations, much less in Saudi Arabia, China, Cuba, and other non-democratic nations. The hope is that over the course of time, people of these nations will see democracy as strengthening rather than weakening them. Historically, the role of the mass media in a democracy is to inform, to provide a vehicle for personal expression, and to serve as a kind of social safety valve for information and viewpoints, even unpopular viewpoints. Criticism of public people and issues, even to the point of this sharp and vehement debate, is often seen as a citizen's responsibility as well as a right. Teddy Roosevelt, a century ago, said, "To announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but it is morally treasonable to the American public." And so, while the democratic theory of law supports public discussion of private issues, it's important to point out that it may also protect private people and private information. The balance between public and private spheres is one of the key factors in media law in any country. Well, media law is part of a larger system of constitutional law and concerns that are founded on a concept of equal justice and the rule of law. Now, this is an ancient concept and one of the most important and hard-fought ideas in human history. The principle is that no one, not even a king, is above the law. Many wars and revolutions have been fought to preserve and extend the basic idea of equal justice, as we will see when we consider the history of free speech. From the constitutional point of view, the law is not a static set of rules, but one that can change to meet changing conditions. But there are ongoing debates about this concept. Conservative scholars see a need to base constitutional law on the original intent of the framers of the U.S. Constitution of 1789. Liberal scholars see the Constitution as a living document that can and should change with the times. Debates between these two schools of thought have underpinned questions about the rights of minority groups and free speech issues for many decades. Now, law as a term has been defined in a number of ways, and some of these are listed on my website. I'm particularly fond of the one that says the law is an ass. Charles Dickens says this in Oliver Twist. And the context of this famous quote is that the character Mr. Bumble has been accused of encouraging his wife to steal jewelry. Even if his wife committed the crime, a lawyer says to Mr. Bumble, "You are the more guilty of the two in the eyes of the law. The law supposes that your wife acts under your direction." This was part of the ancient doctrine of coverture. Mr. Bumble's famous response is, "If the law supposes that," you know, that his wife acts under his direction, "if the law supposes that, the law is an ass, an idiot, If that's the law is a bachelor. And the worst I wish the law is that his eye may be opened by experience. So a little bit of fun there. We're talking also about categories, sources, and institutions of law. And everybody's probably familiar with the two basic categories of law in every country. There's civil law and there's criminal law. In criminal law cases brought by the police or a district attorney, usually after evidence is gathered, those who lose in criminal court may go to jail or serve some other physical punishment along with fines. And the standard of proof in a criminal case, in the United States at least, is guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which puts the probability of guilt in the 95 to 99% range. In civil law, cases brought by any person against any other person or corporation, money and behavior are the only issues at stake. For example, behavior, you could get an injunction against a corporation doing something or a person doing something. In cases that don't involve constitutional issues, the standard of proof is the preponderance of evidence, which could be seen as even as close as 51% versus 49%. But in constitutional cases, especially First Amendment cases, the standard of proof involves what's called a preferred position for constitutional rights. Now, there are five basic sources of law, but they really correspond to the three branches of government, the three classical branches of government, judicial, legislative, and executive. In the judicial branch, there's common or case law, which is really judge-made law, and that was originally based on long legal history and custom stretching back more than 1,000 years. There's also equity law, which is a body of civil law concerned with doing justice where money is inadequate or inappropriate as a remedy. But most importantly is constitutional law at both state and federal levels in the United States and in many other countries. Constitutions provide for a check on the power of the legislature and the executive on the basis of the Constitution. There are countries without a constitution, such as the United Kingdom, Britain, where laws are reviewed only by the parliament, the legislative branch. Now, along with the judicial branch, there's the legislative and executive, of course. So the legislative branch makes statutory laws. The executive branch makes regulations or administrative laws on executive agencies, such as the Federal Communications Commission or the Federal Trade Commission, make regulations in the United States. There's also a category of executive orders that falls under the executive branch. Now, the institutions of law in countries can be very different. We have in the United States a federal system where state courts and federal courts are operate more or less in tandem with the Supreme Court at the top. In the UK, in the English legal system, you have a system where there is no constitution and there's no review of parliamentary law. So that means that a law's constitutionality can't really be considered by the courts, but it can only be changed by parliament. But there is increasing jurisdiction from the European Court of Human Rights in free speech and media law areas. Canada had a very similar system until 1982, when it changed to a Supreme Court system with the introduction of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And Canadian courts gained the power to overturn primary legislation from the parliament. It's important also for us to talk about the process of civil law that's typical in media law cases. So let's take Smith versus Jones as a kind of initial case. So they, let's say Smith files an initial complaint, and then there's preliminary motions, and then there's discovery where they can each find out what evidence they have, and a trial date is set. During the trial, evidence is weighed by the judge or jury depending on the plaintiff's preference. Now, let's say Smith wins and Jones appeals on a point of law, and the case is now called Jones versus Smith. The appeals court reads the brief, hears the oral arguments. Let's say Jones wins and appeals the court's decision, and that appeal could be heard if the Supreme Court granted certiorari, and now the case is Smith versus Jones again, or the Supreme Court could simply refuse to hear the case, and it would stand perhaps as a weak federal precedent. federal court precedent. When the Supreme Court decides in a case, it decides on the basis of the majority, so 5 out of 9 have to agree on an opinion, and the majority write the decision, and the minority members may also write dissenting opinions. Among the important concepts at play here, and I'm going to kind of go back through this process again, due process means that the proceedings are fair to all participants. So, for example, in the very early stages of an investigation, a search warrant might not be as fair as a subpoena when it comes to a demand for, let's say, newsroom materials. There was a case of this in Virginia not long ago, and a prosecutor mistakenly issued a search warrant instead of going to the court and asking for a subpoena. Now, in civil trial procedures, this is very general, of course, but the plaintiff or petitioner presents a petition called a brief to the trial court, and there's 4 parts of this, usually. First of all, they say that they're in the proper court or location or venue. They state the facts of the case, and they state the legal arguments, including precedents on which the case stands, and then they have a prayer for relief or some action that's requested of the court. The respondent, the defendant, responds with an answer to the petition, and the answer may include a motion for summary judgment on the basis of insufficient evidence or possibly on an inaccurate reading of the law, which is called a demurrer. Other preliminary motions might include motions to suppress evidence illegally obtained or motion to change the venue, especially in cases where there's large amounts of publicity, and motions to reschedule a trial to allow more time to prepare. Venue is an important part of the whole process. A civil issue that involves more than one state may be heard in a federal court under diversity jurisdiction. Federal courts also hear cases involving federal laws. Otherwise, cases are heard in state courts. At a trial, if a trial is ordered, there is first a discovery process where both sides learn about the evidence to be presented by the other side, and there may also be interrogatories or questions presented to witnesses of both sides before the trial starts. Sometimes groups that are not named in the complaint but who have a stake in the issues of the trial may file a friend of the court amicus brief. If a jury is to be called, the process of jury selection is called voir dire. When the trial begins, the petitioners and respondents make opening statements, call witnesses, and the way evidence is presented or the way witnesses are questioned may be the subject of a number of challenges from both sides. Now, at some point, the jury or the judge reaches a decision, and then after that, either side can appeal the decision to an appeals court or a higher court for a variety of reasons. If the appeals go up to the Supreme Court, the court is asked to grant certiorari, which means they will hear the case. Now, a court opinion may uphold a lower court or reverse a decision. There may be concurring opinions with different takes on the law or dissenting opinions that come from different court members. At the federal appeals court level, usually only one judge presides, but important cases may be heard en banc with all of the judges. Two of the most important concepts that we need to consider in all of this really are stare decisis, which has to do with letting the precedent stand, and the possibility that laws could be vague or overly broad rather than the narrowly tailored preferred narrowly tailored sort of a law. So stare decisis really is a legal principle that provides stability and predictability by relying on precedents to guide opinions. Judges usually go by the precedent unless there is a good reason to overturn it. You know, for example, when asked about the Roe v. Wade abortion decision from the 1970s, many of the candidates for Supreme Court in recent years said that they were personally opposed to abortion, but the principle of stare decisis was more important. That's a good way to evade the central issue, I think. Vagueness and overbreadth is a problem that is at the heart of many of the kinds of cases that are heard at the Supreme Court. Sometimes when Congress or a state legislature passes a law, the terms are not clear enough, and the law can be seen as reaching too deeply into constitutional rights so that no one knows what's punished and what's permitted. Uncertain laws can be selectively administered, and at times that has been used to violate congressional or constitutional rights. A good law is narrowly tailored to meet compelling interests of society or of the government. So, in summary, what distinguishes media law is that it's almost always civil, only rarely criminal, that media law involves many First Amendment issues directly, but some only indirectly. For example, issues involving the establishment of religion clause are often not media issues. Symbolic speech issues are not often mass media issues. In addition, a good deal of media law involves non-First Amendment areas such as reporter privilege, access to courts, broadcast ownership, regulation, and so on. Media law can involve both structural issues and content issues. The structural issues usually involve statutory and regulatory law in the way that, for example, there could be a cross controversy over cross-ownership where newspapers would own TV stations in the same town, for example. That's an ongoing structural issue in the United States. Sometimes the government is involved when structural issues are at stake, such as in antitrust, as in anti-monopoly lawsuits. Now, content issues are usually civil issues between a plaintiff and a respondent. In the U.S., content issues obviously are going to involve constitutional law and sometimes common law. So prior restraint, libel, invasion of privacy, and obscenity are all common law issues tried in civil courts. Copyright and some broadcasting content issues are governed by statutory and regulatory law. So media law emerges from a large complex of historical tradition and especially from the struggle for religious and political freedoms. That is a historical struggle that we're going to talk about next. So thank you for listening in on this first issue of the Media Law and Ethics podcast, and we'll move on to the second part with some information about the history of the struggle for free speech and freedom of expression through the ages.